You are listening to Heart of Mind Radio, and this is the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. My name is Catherine Davis. This is a program that enjoys exploration, and really it's an exploration of the self. And as we explore into our own state of being, we really do learn more about each other because we are so much more alike than we have differences. So I do enjoy having an engagement with you and with various guests so that we can look at the various aspects of our lives and see how we can make that better. On today's program, we're going to be looking at intuition. We're going to hear an interview with Judith Orloff, and you'll hear a bit of music. That's Angelique Kidjo, Summertime. So let's go to the interview.
Judith Orloff, MD, is a psychiatrist, an empath, an intuitive healer, and New York Times best-selling author. Her latest book is The Power of Surrender, Let Go and Energize Your Relationships, Success and Well-Being. Her other bestsellers are Emotional Freedom, Second Sight, Positive Energy, and Intuitive Healing. Dr. Orloff synthesizes the pearls of traditional medicine with cutting-edge knowledge of intuition, energy, and spirituality. She also specializes in treating empaths, highly sensitive people. She is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA. Dr. Orloff passionately believes that the future of medicine involves integrating all the wisdom to achieve emotional freedom and total wellness. Her work has been featured on the Today Show, CNN, Oprah Magazine, and USA Today. And we will all learn a great deal from her during today's program. And we're going to actually be talking to you about how you can connect with her work and actually see her when she comes into town a little bit later. I just want to say hello and welcome, Judith Orloff.
Oh, hi. I'm so happy to be on your show.
Yes, I'm very happy to have you. We're focusing in this moment on the power of surrender. Let go and energize your relationships, success, and well-being. And this is Judith's newest best-selling book. Judith, I really wanted to talk to you about your book. It's interesting. I was talking to someone about the work that you're doing and this whole concept of the power of surrender. And the person I was speaking to said, surrender? That must be the hardest thing to do in the world. And it was a concept. And it was a concept that was like, What are you talking about?
I know where they're coming from. The reason I wanted to write a book about surrender was that I wanted to learn to do it more in my life as a psychiatrist, as a woman, as an empath, because I know that holding and clenching and overthinking is not good for the human body or soul. And so I wrote the book to give people guidelines of how to make it easier to surrender, because I know your friend is so right. You know, when the ego gets involved, you just don't want to surrender anything.
But for your
well-being, you know, and your happiness, if you want happiness, it's very important to learn the skill.
So I think also part of the conversation I was having is because the person was equating surrender with giving up or giving over power to someone else. So can you speak to really what you mean by surrender?
Yes, that's the old definition of surrender, more of a military view, you know, where you surrender your troops. But that isn't what I'm saying. The way I'm using surrender is an evolutionary leap into how to be a different kind of person and achieve a higher level of wellness and peace. It means knowing what to let go of, like stress, toxic relationships, or anything that's not serving you in your life, like fear, anger, and worry, to try and find a better place to be so you don't spend the bulk of your life suffering. And so when you learn to let go at the right moments, it's the art of living. I'm not saying to lay down and be passive and be a doormat. I'm saying just know when. If you're talking with an emotional vampire, somebody I talk about in the book, Draining People, you have to know how to do the dance with them so you're not run over. You have to learn how to set clear boundaries and limits without being triggered. And that means surrendering old patterns of being triggered by people who annoy you or upset you. So just that one letting go, that one surrender, can improve your life so enormously. I can't even say how important it is.
So for someone who is grasping at what you're speaking of, what does it look like to surrender? Does it mean... you're not saying disengage necessarily, but there's something happening internally where you're setting up this internal boundary, and, or you're not absorbing the person's negativity, not getting hooked into their negativity. Can you explain to people a little bit more of what this means?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes surrender does mean letting go of certain people in your life who are toxic, negative, and that you don't need. But you know, a lot of people you can't let go of, such as family members, you know, who are there, or if you're working with a narcissist boss, let's say, and you don't want to change your job, you have to learn how to surrender your old patterns of dealing with it so that you can approach them in a more productive way. For instance, if you're involved with a narcissist, somebody who is totally me, 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 and has what's called a, quote, empathy deficient disorder, who doesn't have the capacity for empathy like other people, you have to learn to lower your expectations, frame things in terms of how it will serve them, and try and surrender all of the low self-esteem buttons that get pushed by this person, which means you have to go back in your own life and say, you know, was my father causing low self-esteem, and that's why I have it with my boss. But in any case, you're learning to see the person realistically, then surrender whatever unhealthy patterns you have with them so that you can be more at peace when you're dealing with difficult people.
That's really important. And just on a personal note, maybe this applies. I've recently been engaging with someone who has a tendency to accuse of whatever it is that they're thinking. So if they're thinking something, then they accuse you of treating them that way.
Right.
So is that kind of what you're speaking of? And then you find yourself trying to defend. Well, what are you talking about? So it's a curious thing to deal with people in a real world situation like that.
That's exactly why I wrote the book. And that's what I'm hoping people can get from it, is how to deal with real life situations in new ways, rather than just defending when you're accused.
Yeah.
Now, of course you want to defend when you're accused, but it's not really going to work, you know, with the person to change the pattern. You know, you want to be able to calm yourself, center yourself, and practice a technique that I talk about in the book called the sandwich technique. And that is when you want to get something across to somebody, you frame the difficult issue, the request that you want to change, such as, you know, my feelings are hurt when you accuse me of things that I don't feel that I do. In between, I love you as a friend, and it's so meaningful to me that we have this relationship, and I'd like to put in this request. Put in your request, then say something positive about the person again. Because if you use that technique that I talk about in the Surrender book, you can have a better chance of changing the dynamic.
That makes so much sense, and it's easy to forget, because if once you get triggered, you just... rolling down that hill, and it tends to decompensate the whole situation. That's really good.
Absolutely. That's why I really suggest to people in the book to write down your goals. For instance, if you're working with this one goal about being triggered by being accused, you know, write down the solution saying, I will develop a more positive way of dealing with this, so that you remember, because we forget. We think, oh, you know, people might be listening to me and say, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But then when you get in the situation, you're triggered, bam, and you're off and running with the person again. And surrender means identifying the pattern you like to change and surrendering your tendency to be triggered you know, and looking at why am I so triggered by this person? Who else accused me in my life, you know, earlier on that would make this more than annoying? Of course it's annoying when somebody accuses you, but why am I fighting with them about it? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the difference. And, you know, just a simple success or powerful success of changing this one pattern can increase your energy level in your life so much. This one pattern. And in the book, I have a chapter on relationships and energy vampires, on how to surrender your old patterns with them. And as far as I'm concerned, if that's your issue, you can just read that chapter in the book. You don't have mm-hmm. to read the rest of it, if it doesn't resonate with you. The other issues, such as, you know, how can I surrender unproductive patterns about success? How can I be more successful? Maybe that's what you're more interested in, so you can go to that chapter. But, you know, I've written the book so that each chapter is really tailored to different needs you might have and what you can surrender.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that that's very powerful, but it is also a book that if someone did choose to read the whole book, which is actually what I would recommend, because these are all tools that weave into each other, really. And if you begin to look at yourself in terms of the wholeness of your being, then you do want to look at your relationships. You do want to look at your sexuality and your sensuality, and, you know, are you comfortable physically with people? You might want to look at where I am emotionally. So even though one of these things may stand out more for each of us, I think we could all stand to at least look at where we are in all these areas of our life, because truly when you want to have a good life experience, you need to look at the whole self. So that's, I think that the whole book is very valuable, and I would hope that people would take the time to read the whole book, because it's engaging and it's really helpful. And in your book, you, like as you said, you talk about these different areas, and I'm wondering if you would give us like a little tidbit on each one so that people can understand how it works in each form. And you may have been already speaking about one of them, but you have like intellectual surrender, emotional, physical, and spiritual. Can you let people know what you mean by those different parts of ourselves?
Well, intellectual surrender means giving up the need to be right or having ideas about how a person should be or behave or how life should be. Life should, like, for instance, life should treat me more fairly. You know, that kind of idea, you know, of course, but life is unfair at times. So the nature of, you know, it's understanding the nature of life and letting go of rigid beliefs that don't serve you. That's intellectual surrender. And holding on to beliefs that do serve you. I mean, I'm constantly reevaluating my beliefs every day, so it's a constant changing process. And then emotional surrender can be surrendering worry, which is so big, so big. I mean, imagine a life where you worry 50% less. You know, it's just a beautiful life. And I'm realistic because I know people worry, and I'm a psychiatrist, and I talk to people all the time, and they worry. You know, worry is a human emotion, but just letting go of it and having faith and trust more, replacing worry with faith and trust, surrendering worry, surrendering fear to not lead a fear-driven life. This fear can just sabotage you in every area. And then physical surrender, sexual surrender, is letting go to your own sensuality, to not just staying up in your head, to letting go, to feel the breeze. I'm not talking about having sex necessarily, but it could apply to that. But just opening up your sensual relationship to your body, feeling the breeze, feeling the sunlight. Just don't think your way down the street. Feel your way down the street. You know, really be a whole person in feeling your ankles and your calves and your thighs, and letting go to a sense of your body's innate sensuality, sacred sensuality. And, you know, that's related to spiritual surrender, which is surrendering to the higher angels that are at work in your life, surrendering to a higher power in your life, whatever that is, however you define it, you know. And just knowing that you're not alone and that you're a vessel to do good. I strongly believe that when you make a spiritual surrender, what I do every day is that I ask to be, you know, let in the kingdom of love, you know, so that I can be in the kingdom of spirit, so I can be in the right place when I start my day, you mm-hmm. know, not just in my head and my to-do list. That's a small, small portion of who you are. No, you want to open up your day with surrendering to Spirit and being a vessel for Spirit to work through you so that you can make contributions, large and small, to your own life, to your community, and to your world. And it's a beautiful thing to walk around the world and be aware that you are connected to Spirit. So there's intellectual surrender, there's spiritual, physical, and emotional surrender. And, you know, you just work on them, chip away at them little by little, and the more you do, the freer you will be.
And that's something that I think everyone longs for, to have that space of freedom, and freedom to me is to be at peace inside.
Exactly.
No matter what's going on in the world, if you can be at peace within yourself and with yourself, then it doesn't make so much difference what's going on around you. But you also speak about trust. And are we speaking about self-trust or trust in greater power or all those things?
All those things. That trusting the self is important, and that's why I write so much about intuition, and that's the topic of my workshop on the 13th, is intuition, is learning to trust the still small voice inside of yourself and not second guess it. When you get a gut feeling somebody is not good for you, you better trust it or else you're in for big trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, you will get into a bad relationship if you don't trust it. Or trust that something is good for you. You know, when you get a yes inside, you get, this is exciting. You know, this feels right. Maybe it doesn't fit my vision, but it feels right. I'm going to try it. And so you're not afraid to try something new when you get an intuitive yes. So that's trusting the self, is trusting your intuition.
Mm-hmm. And when people feel that resistance, maybe because they've had fear, they went and did something already and they didn't have a good outcome, what would you say to people to lessen that fear resistance to moving into that state of trust?
Just be very gentle and loving with yourself. Fear is so daunting. I think it's the biggest human challenge we have, is to deal with fear. Mm. And when fears accumulate, they stand in the way of feeling Spirit. Everything becomes dark, so you can't see the light. So it has a lot of power. I know that as a physician, you know what, and personally, when I've let my fears build up, what it can do. And so you want to just very gently identify your fears, top five fears, whatever they are, fear of intimacy, fear of lack of success, fear I'll never find my soulmate, whatever your fears are, and to very gently ask them to be relieved and to say, I'm going to have trust and faith that my dreams will come true, rather than having that negative voice going round and round and round of fear. I'm so afraid. Nothing's going to happen. I'm so anxious. It's never going to stop. That's the nature of the fear voice versus take a breath, exhale, bring yourself back to the moment. That's always the surrender with fear. If you bring yourself back to the moment instead of making the worst case scenarios of the future, that relieves a lot of fear immediately. Just say, I can handle walking down the street, hopefully. I can handle getting out of bed. I can handle going into my job just for today. So that helps with fear a lot.
And I want to remind all of you, we are speaking to Judith Orloff, MD, and she's been telling us about her newest book, The Power of Surrender, a roadmap for helping us let go of our fears and anxieties. That's what Deepak Chopra says about this book. And it helps us to let go and energize your relationships, success, and well-being. And it's a very beautiful book. And it's true, the name of it indicates what's here, The Power of Surrender. But it's a very powerful book because it helps you to be empowered through your own actions, through taking steps, through understanding, being gentle with yourself, and making that transformation. Now, what I love about doing this work, and the reason that I bring people to the air, such as yourself, Judith, is because I see how much of a difference you're making in people's lives. I have followed your career and gone to different seminars. I've read different books, starting with Positive Energy. And I can just see how much it has made a transformation for people. And I enjoy bringing you to the air. And also for our listeners, I want you to understand that this is something that's important, that can really make a difference for you. And beyond, we're interested in your well-being.
do a deeper research into this art of dying, spiritual, scientific, and practical approaches to living and dying. I am one who has had a close relationship to this experience. I think we all have that opportunity, but we don't always, we can't move through that fear to be able to be there for the persons in our life that are having this experience. And this is one of the really important parts of this, that we can begin to move through that apprehension and fear and tenseness about being able to really move with a person through this journey, to be able to talk to them, to be able to help them to ease their way. And I think this is something that the living has in the past done, and we are in need of moving into that space again, certainly because too many of our relatives end up isolated in hospitals and nursing homes and being faced with going through this experience alone. And if we, in a loving way, can make a difference for those people in our lives that we truly care about, this is a help, because not that there should be guilt about that, but if we could move away obstacles to that level of suffering on the part of our relatives, on the part of ourselves, I think that would be extremely valuable for us to do. And now we're going to go to another interview, as I described. And to me, this was a most exciting interview because Robert Thurman, known as Tenzin Thurman, he is very closely related to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he is a part of the Ecumenical Order of Tibetan Buddhism that is connected to the Dalai Lama. And so he has such a long history of understanding the wisdom of the Tibetan Buddhist, not from a religious perspective, but in terms of really understanding the realms of experience, the living experience, the in-between experience, and the after experience. So I invite you to stay tuned. We're going to do a full interview coming up right now. So please do stay tuned.
Listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's bird when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's bird in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never lived, but dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees, they are in the groaning woods, they are in the crying grass, they are in the moaning rocks, but dead are not under the earth. So listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never lived, but dead have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast, they are in the waiting child, they are with us in the home, they are with us in the crowd, but dead have a pact with the living. So listen more often to things than to things unto beings. 'Tis the ancestor's word. When the fire's voice is heard, 'tis the ancestor's word. In the voice of the water, I was listen,
Robert Tenzin Thurman, PhD, a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies in the Department of Religion at Columbia University. He's president of Tibet House in the U.S. and president of the American Institute of Buddhist Studies, which is dedicated to the publication of translations of important Tibetan artistic and scientific treaties. He is the author of many books on Tibetan Buddhism, art, politics, and culture, and is a Vajrasana Buddhist priest, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Ecumenical Order of Tibetan Buddhism. Robert Tenzin Thurman, PhD, is a professor of religion at Columbia University and Vajrasana in His Holiness the Dalai Lama's Ecumenical Order of Tibetan Buddhism. Welcome so much to the program.
Thank you.
We're so happy to have you here, and for many reasons, because you have such a tremendous perspective to offer us on life as much as the whole idea of death and dying. And I know you're going to be presenting at this conference, and I'm encouraging folks to participate so they can get the full breadth of what you have to offer. But I would invite you to introduce whatever idea you want to introduce at this time with regard to the wisdom of Tibetan Buddhism and the art of living and dying.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's awfully nice of you. And the Tibetans had a very realistic society, and they, especially since for about the last 500 years, they have been a more or less demilitarized society. And I did have the joy of translating a version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which has a number of versions out there, but I did another one. And in the process of doing that, it gave me pause as to why particularly the Tibetan society had such a popular book that sort of was based on people living close to death while being alive. And I was trying to figure out why is it the science of this was known in India, the science of the dying process and the after-death process, which are very interconnected in those cultures, and very well known in India, but India never produced a popular book of this type, which they then did. They used the Indian science, subtle science about that, and they produced in Tibet. And then finally, I think I figured it out. It had to do with the demilitarization of Tibet. If you have a country where the elite or the ruling power, at least occasionally, if not all the time, wants people to go to war and wants people to serve, sort of using their life in service to the ruler, in that life and death way, in war and in otherwise just spending all their time that way, then it's better that they live more in denial and in unawareness of their death. And they act like they're going to always sort of be going on, so there's no rush about anything. And because when you confront your death while alive, even perfectly healthy, even young, then it makes you want to use your moments of life very meaningfully and purposefully. And you're a little bit loath to jump into someone's army and go off and get killed so they can earn, they can like win a few acres away from their neighbor or other kinds of sort of pointless activity for you as an individual. And you sort of want to like flourish as best you can in this life moment by moment. So then you are automatically interested in methodologies that they teach in Buddhism, like mindfulness, being in the moment, cultivating virtue, shifting your negative habits into positive ones and so on, and virtuous ones. And but in a way, it makes you a bit less manageable by the authority. So authoritarian societies and all militaristic societies are in some sense authoritarian, whatever their theories about whether people are free or not. All authoritarian societies, you seek to suppress people's confronting the reality that they're going to die, that their life is of a limited time, and that when they do, then lots of the different things that they are doing will end up being sort of useless to them. You know, like how much you have in the bank doesn't really help when you're dying. You know, once you die, it's gone. You know, someone else will write those checks. When you know, even some of your relationships will no longer be important. Your possessions, your house, your clothing, all sorts of things, even your sort of, you know, the shape of your body and your physical beauty and strength and so forth, these things all become less relevant when you leave your body. And so they become, it doesn't mean that you then neglect yourself entirely, but it means that you reorder your priorities. And you especially, you decide you want to get in charge of your own unconscious. You want to get in charge of the impulses in your mind. You want to make sure that if there is an after-death state, even if you don't have a belief in one, if there is one, that your mind will be clear, you will have powers of concentration, you will be fearless, and you won't get into sort of dark, shadowy, nightmarish type of situations. So I think that I came up away from my work on the Book of the Dead with that lesson. And then the second question is, how does that apply to our living situation nowadays? And actually, we live in a rather militaristic society and also industrially highly organized, where we're taught that our self-worth entirely depends on how much we produce, rather than that we have an intrinsic self-worth that we just, because we are, you know, we are, therefore we're worthy. We don't really, that's something you have to strive to achieve, such an insight, because we're not taught that. So in our society, being aware of death for a quite healthy living person is very, very valuable. And then we do, of course, have a lot of people dying. And as we grow older, a lot of our friends go, dear ones go, and then we will go. But before that, we probably will have a lot of people we know go. Now, what can we do for them? What does this sense of the Book of the Dead, the science of death, you could call it, that the Tibetans cultivated, the Indians and Tibetans particularly cultivated, what does that have to do? How can we help others with that? And therefore, like, what am I doing in the Art of Dying conference? What am I talking about? Well, what I'm talking about is that I think it helps people to have a map of the dying, and especially the after-dying process, what the Tibetans call the bardo, which literally translates, and which I call in English, the between. And so the between is like a dreamlike state in which your mind awakens after some period of time after you die, because at first you're kind of like in a coma. You're like out of it, you know, as far as your normal consciousness goes, because you don't have any sense faculties, because they've all shut down, you know. But then you do awaken, just as when you go in a deep sleep at night and shut down your sense organ functioning, you then wake up in a dream. And in the dream, you have an environment around you, and you have a feeling of being in a subjectivity in the environment, and even being a body in the environment. Although often you're kind of unaware of your body and you just feel you're a point of awareness in a dream. And this is the same thing that happens in the between after death. And so then there are certain types of things that are described in the Book of the Dead and how should you react, and some instructions as to how you should react to them. There's instructions about, because at first, when you die, you don't kind of know you die. When you come up awake like that, and you think, like, wait a minute, I'm just here, and you run over to some dear one or near one, and you try to attract their attention, and you sort of go right through them, and they don't see you, and they don't feel you. And maybe some intuitives might, but mostly they don't. You know, you're in a sort of ghostly, a little bit phase in relating to the previous solid reality. And then also you can have visions in the between reality that are frightening, sort of big boulders falling on you, or being in a hurricane or an earthquake, or some fierce animals pursuing you, wolves or something, and you can be very frightened, or some people giving you a hard time. You can have nightmarish things. You can also have pleasant things. And how to steer your consciousness with its subtle sort of virtual embodiment that it has in that is something that the instructions are very, very valuable for. Even the instruction to you that that's what's happening to you, because you tend to be confused after you die. Now, some people might say, well, most of us in modern times, we don't expect to have any after-death experience. And even science sort of tells us that our brain, when it stops, we no longer have subjective experience. And that's questionable. On what basis does science tell us that? Actually, there's no evidence that science has gathered of somebody not existing. They didn't find any non-existent people. They do find bodies that no longer have minds in them, so that, you know, the brain no longer functions, the heart no longer beats. So then one thing they verify, that there's no consciousness in the body. Well, we agree. The Tibetans agree with that. But the scientists have not found a lack of consciousness elsewhere. They don't find consciousness being present in nothing, for the simple reason that they've never found nothing. And not only that is the simple reason, but in principle, they never will find nothing. Nobody can find nothing. Nothing is nothing, and therefore you can't find it. That's what it means. And so the idea that that consciousness, which is a continuum of energy while alive, that it suddenly becomes nothing, is really very irrational, and it's an unevidenced proposition. It's not actually a known truth based on experience or discovery. That's not true. And actually, everybody subliminally, kind of, even the most convinced materialist, Carl Sagan, if you will, my grandfather, convinced materialist, you know, nothing to do with religions and all that, they have an unconscious fear that maybe they will have a further consciousness as they're facing death. They kind of worry about it. Therefore, sometimes they will call in a rabbi or a minister or a priest and, you know, ask for some sort of blessing. And they will also definitely, everyone will call in all their relatives and their dear ones or even enemies and try to express forgiveness or receive forgiveness. People do that because, I mean, they wouldn't really care if they were sure, subconsciously as well as consciously, as well as in theory, if they were really sure they would become nothing, then why bother to forgive anybody or do anything? It doesn't mean anything, because you're just going to not exist. So I believe, and what I like to contribute in the Art of Dying conferences that we've held for years with the Open Center, and wonderful, wonderful contribution that they do in society, they're carrying on themselves, and that is to provide plausible maps to people who are facing death, as we all are, no matter how young and healthy we may be, and of what you might expect. And, you know, to echo Blaise Pascal, the famous French mathematician, you know, you kind of wager that it's a no-lose wager, in the sense that you say, well, if nothing happens after death, and I really do be, and I really have no awareness forever, like the materialists say, then I will not be regretting that I learned about some possible maps of after-death experience, because I won't exist. But if I do have to navigate some after-death experience, then it would be very good that I'm prepared for that. And so I might as well prepare, especially since it doesn't take a whole lot of time. And that's sort of my contribution. And then people can go in a more secure and confident manner to face death. And, of course, they will immediately, one of the wonderful things about the between teachings, or what you might call the bardo teachings of the Tibetans, is that the minute you become fully, you leave denial that you're going to die, and you fully face the fact of your death whenever it may be, well, and also you face the fact that you don't know exactly when it will be, could be any time, then you this makes you realize that here in life, you're in a transition phase also. And you are, you know, everything changes all the time around you in life. And in a way, life is called the life between birth and death. And in that between, there's tremendous options of what to do and how to do it. You can get better and better at different things. You can feel better and better and be happier and happier. Or you can get worse and worse and be more and more miserable. There's all kinds of things that, you know, are different ways of traversing this life or the between of this life. And so then you suddenly see this life in a different light. And you realize the value of every moment of your awareness. And you want to be mindful of that awareness. And you want to be aware in the most lucid and positive and loving and wise way so as to maximize the purpose of this life and also to be of help to others and have more also fun and bring more fun to others. So that's sort of what my piece of it is, you know. And, of course, there's a lot of detail in that. It connects very nicely with what some other presenters will be presenting in the conference, which are the people who are experts in the near-death experience, reports that we have from many people who clinically were supposed to have died, or their brain stopped temporarily, their heart stopped temporarily, and then they were revived and so for some reason, sometimes due to medical intervention and sometimes just miraculously without anybody knowing why. And they all have a tale to tell, and there's a lot of resemblances of the tale to tell, so much so that you begin to develop a kind of composite picture of what the dying process is like. Although since they finally don't die, that is, they come back, you know, the bardo, the between process may be more complex and more profound in a way. But still, the near-death experience is very powerful for many people. It changes the way they live life afterwards totally. And it gives the one who becomes familiar with that literature and those many very, very vital and vivid reports, it gives them a sense of what it might be like. And it fits beautifully, dovetails very, very well with the Tibetan descriptions of the between state. And so that's also when I go to these conferences and present myself, I always try to go to those near-death experience people. And also people who, on the basis of other spiritual traditions, do present ways of focusing at the time of death and the time of dying. And although they don't, none of them that I know of have anything quite as systematic as the Tibetan one, which is unique, I believe, on the planet, they still have quite a good sense of what you may expect and what you should look for and how you should prepare yourself. And that's all also very, very interesting. And so that's the thing.
Excellent.
Do you have other questions?
Well, I had an experience myself where,
really?
When my mother, not a near-death experience from the conventional sense, but when my mother passed away, I was with her.
Uh-huh.
And I had this experience, we had a very close relationship, as she was dying, leaving, I could mm-hmm. feel my essence sort of falling into her eyes, and I found myself drawn into this other sort of expansive space.
Wow.
That I might have stayed in had not the doctors come in and disturbed us. But it was very interesting to me that having that experience, and then a little bit later, after, you know, maybe 6 months after she was gone, I had this experience where I felt myself moving down that white hallway or that white light that people
yes.
tell you about. And at the end of it, I entered a room and she was there.
Wow,
and so
wonderful.
And we had this communication. And then afterwards, I wasn't planning to leave, but she convinced me to leave. And I found myself walking back down this hallway. And then I opened a door. And as I opened that door, I was stepping into my living room, and then I went, and I felt like I was sitting, I sat down into my body. So it felt like an out-of-body experience. I had no language for it.
Amazing.
But
that's
I was
wonderful.
But I was wondering if you could translate, like, this in-between space as something that's a part of us now, if we could
yes,
expand
that
to
is,
it.
Actually, you're reminding me of another thing that I do when I give a longer talk. And that is, I have received, actually, my translation of the Book of the Dead and my study of the process is my best-selling book by far, and I've had letters from all over the world of people who've had a very happy experience with it, who are the bereaved people, who are seeing someone off like you're describing, and someone off into the travel of that undiscovered country, as Hamlet calls it, you know, from whose bourne no traveler returns. Although we don't agree with Shakespeare that no one returns, they actually do return. But anyway, that is when people's dear ones die. And then they have this, you know, our cultural thing is to get all grieving and mournful and all so miserable. And we will cry and we will grieve, and that's normal and healthy, of course. But rather than just emphasizing that, there's a sense of the continuity of the person in the between who has gone. And then the Book of the Dead gives these prayers and instructions and things which one can read and direct the reading to the person who is gone, on the basis that in the early days of the between, not the very first day or two, but then after that, the early days, when the traveler, the departed is in the between, they are aware of what their dear ones think and say and even how they feel, which is why one's supposed to stay a little cheery. Like, that's why Irish wake is a very good cultural, that gains the stamp of approval of the Tibetans, the Irish wake, where people are kind of jolly at the death, at least for a while, and they may take months and years grieving too after that. But there's the cultural thing of where you have a party sort of for the departed, and you send out a feeling of good cheer, which is communicated emotionally to the departed who are hovering around, and it gives them a feeling of confidence, because they're confused. And then if their dear ones are in a state of freak out, then they think maybe something terrible has happened, and they become more fearful, and it's more difficult for them to navigate. And also the bereaved person, even whether or not in a particular case the one who has departed actually hears them. Maybe they're distracted by something else, or they've gone off to the other side of the galaxy. No one knows. But whether or not, the ones who are bereaved have a wonderful feeling that they are communicating with the departed, and usually they are, actually. And it's a wonderful thing. It's like, okay, dear Madeline, please don't be afraid if you see something. And you have a wonderful moment now where you are very, very enlightened, actually, and you're clairvoyant, and you can read my mind, and you know this and that, and you must focus on, you want to go to a good place, you want to be reborn in a good way, or go to a nice heaven, and these are the different heavens, and this is how you do it. And if you see a certain light, go for the bright light, even like a strobe or something, like a discotheque. Don't go for a dark, shadowy place, because the light seems too bright. And you give this kind of instruction, and the bereaved people feel very pleased and happy that they're able to communicate. And by thinking that they are going to, they sometimes do have experiences, although yours is particularly profound and vivid, both of them, the initial one where you were interrupted, and then later where you went down a corridor kind of in the light and then went in a room and there was Mom. I mean, that's wonderful. That's so lucky of you to have that. That changed your life, I'm sure,
Yeah, it was a defining moment.
And so that's a second bonus of this idea of mapping the condition and mapping the process and helping people get your hand. And it doesn't mean that one nice thing about Buddhist science is that they are like modern science in that they think they're not absolutist. In other words, they don't think that just the way we describe it is how it has to be. They're flexible, and it'll be a little different for this person and that person. They're aware of that, and they're open to that. And so it doesn't matter. It's not that, the person, 2 days after dying, remembering the Book of the Dead, and they're having a different kind of experience, and they want a refund. It isn't that sort of situation. It's rather, this is like what that was, but for me it's this way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I put that in my Book of the Dead. With someone who's a Christian, for example, they can expect to meet Jesus if they're fortunate, or an angel, or if someone's Jewish, they can meet an angel, Michael or Gabriel or something. And if they're Muslim, they'll meet Al-Khidr, Muslims have some angels too, et cetera. If they're Hindus, they'll meet Krishna. If they're Taoists, they'll meet Zhuangzi, I think, in the form of a butterfly. So, you know, that's why I've tried to build that in, that people should not get fixated on just this Buddhist symbolism. And the guide that you might meet will look just exactly like this. It might look like something else for you.
It may look like an ancestor.
So what you say, which you happen because of your personal affinity and your sensitivity, a lot of people wouldn't have had that experience. But if they study the between and they look at this kind of map of it and look at it sort of technically, then this might help them open up to having such a wonderful experience as you had.
Thank you so much. I can't tell you how wonderful it's been to talk to you.
It's been very nice
and,
talking to you.
I'm definitely
moved by your experience.
Thank you. I'm definitely want to invite you back.
Snow falls down. Come to me.